Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Jason Furman, as I mentioned, with us now with Tom in our Bloomberg 99.1 studios, former chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, professor of the practice of economic policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. And Jason, let me start with these comments that we just heard from Michel Barnier a few moments ago, standing alongside David Davis. He said, "We've worked constructively. We clarified certain points without making massive steps forward here." What do you make of the latest iteration of these Brexit talks here, I guess expressing some optimism that we might have something closer to a deal or progress toward a deal in 2 months' time? How are you watching all of this unfold in Brussels?
I mean, this is going to be the headline for the next year and a half. No progress made. Maybe we're going to talk again. And then at the very end, they'll get serious. That's how these things work. It's worth paying attention to some in the meantime. But, what's going to take to succeed here is for the UK to become realistic. They went into this wildly unrealistic about their leverage, wildly unrealistic about what they could accomplish. They sold to their voters a package of things that wasn't possible. And with each step of this, I think there has been some increasing realization by the UK about some of the constraints they face, some of the leverage they have, and that's what's going to be needed to get a deal here.
Do you see the same newly strong-seeming Europe that I see, having talked to some European commissioners? There's a sense that I get that there's more cohesion and more Euro positivity, I think, than we've seen in some time.
Yeah, you have the economy looking up throughout Europe. You have had a couple elections where you dodged bullets, and no major banking or some other crisis that was hanging over the continent for about 5 years up until a few years ago. So I think there's still big challenges. All of those challenges are still there. I think people like President Macron are really going to need to deliver for the macroeconomy of France, which is not going to be an easy task. But right now, it feels the best it's felt in years for Europe.
As Margaret Thatcher said, expect the unexpected. And Jason, we're living it this morning. For those of you who were up watching the Yankees and not paying attention to tax reform is something exciting on
it. Did you watch the whole game, Tom?
Evening. No, I did. I didn't. I had it on the whole time, but I had the surveillance slumber. Yeah. But I did notice through it and loved what I saw. That was just really, really wonderful. Mr. Francona will look great in a Red Sox uniform again. Good morning, Bloomberg 106.1 FM in Boston. Jason overnight, Sam Fleming at the FT and Bloomberg's economic team as well. Mick Mulvaney goes after the IMF, really, I thought, quite harshly on two things: tax reform and then how it links in the deficit management and debt management. Which is more important for the IMF to analyze, tax reform, or is it really back where we were, which is about growing deficits?
Right. First of all, there's two different issues here. One is, does the IMF have the right to comment on the U.S. economy?
And you and Victor Gaspar say absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whether you agree with them or not, they absolutely have the
like
right.
They have like a legislated
That's
right.
That's what they do. Yeah. They do Article 4s for every country in the world. They used to do it with me. They would come in, they'd talk, they'd press us. The second question is the IMF right in this debate? I think very much
so. Okay, but this is critical. You just said it. You've been in the chair, in the office, and a bunch of smart PhDs from the IMF come in, and do they grill you? I mean, what's the tone
they
in that meeting?
They ask tough questions on the entire range of issues. They do fiscal, they do housing, they do financial. They talk about, they'll talk about poverty and inequality.
I'm not going to mince words. This is too important, folks, right now. Kevin Hassett is a Penn PhD. He's completely qualified to deal with anyone across the range of our political economics. Do you have confidence that others in the Trump administration can keep up with the PhDs from the IMF?
The notable thing about what the IMF said about the administration is it's consistent with what the administration's budget itself said. The administration a couple months ago put out a budget in which tax reform was not only revenue neutral, but OMB Director Mulvaney testified that that revenue neutrality was without assuming any economic impacts of the tax cut under so-called conventional or dynamic scoring. So the IMF was simply reasserting what the Trump administration itself had claimed in their budget. So know, in terms of their economic officials, I don't know. I think there's a certain interest in not understanding these issues. And when you have an interest in not understanding something, it's very hard to teach it to someone.
What I always loved about the annual meetings is D.C. becomes more fashionable, at least around Foggy Bottom during the course of these meetings. You have all these international economic professionals in town. Jason, let me ask you about the theme of this year's meetings. Of course, in the past, it's been Greece or it's been the financial crisis. Is the theme the IMF and the World Bank itself? Is it multilateralism? Is this an introspective conference this year?
Look, first of all, the good news is the theme isn't the global economy is much worse than we thought it was, so we're downgrading our forecast, which was the main theme of the meetings for the last many years. And yeah, I think that does give us a little bit of a position to introspect and think about what a rules-based multilateral system does, ways it can be improved.
The heart of the matter for all of our listeners worldwide is a belief. It's an ancient belief. Taxes are bad. If you cut taxes, that's good, and growth will improve. I mean, Glenn Hubbard was on the other day with an amendment of supply-side economics towards that, and he was very responsible, frankly, in his comments. Dr. Furman, that's not in Vitar Gaspar's textbooks. That wasn't in your textbooks at Harvard. Where did this thought come from of Trump tax reform policy if it's not in the textbooks? Where did it come from?
The only way to cut taxes is to cut spending. If you cut taxes without cutting spending, you're just shifting the taxes to the future. You're not actually cutting taxes in any meaningful sense. If this administration wanted to put forward a serious plan to cut entitlements and to cut taxes, you know, I think there would be a set of values issues with that. I might take issue with that, but not on terms of economic growth. But in terms of economic growth, this isn't a tax cut.
David,
this is a tax shift.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this is just absolutely crucial. If Douglas Holtz Eakin was sitting here studying at Princeton under Bernanke, the two of you, Furman and Holtz Eakin, have a lot of commonality and a lot of differences in political economics. But both of you would agree that we are going to see a deficit expansion under these various proposals, correct, to GDP?
Absolutely. I mean, I could have a heated argument as to whether tax cuts pay for 10% of themselves, 20% of themselves, 30% of themselves, or maybe even hurt the economy so much that they cost more than the headline cost. I don't know any serious economist that would put a number higher than 30% on the offset for tax cuts. And that means instead of adding $1.5 trillion to the debt, you're adding $1 trillion to the debt. Well, either one of those numbers is, you know, bad and something we can't afford in the long run.
Well, apparently our surging stock market is paying for everything, according to the president last night, at least paying off the debt. Well, let me ask you here lastly just about trade, Jason, as these conversations continue, the fourth round of NAFTA renegotiation talks continue. How worried are you that we're going to see a termination of that deal?
I'm worried. And, you know, it just – I don't think it's something that most of the people in the administration want, but there's one particular person who might want it, and he has a certain amount of influence in his own administration. And – you know, some of these ideas, like it automatically sunsets every 5 years, it's almost tantamount to ending it. It adds a huge amount of uncertainty for businesses. I think it might even be designed to add that uncertainty for businesses. And that's precisely the opposite of what, you know, the benefits that NAFTA accomplished.
I hear the chopper. Tom, you got to go.
Yeah, the chopper. It just landed. Jason Furman, thank you so much, former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. I'm going to say this very quickly. I remember when Yaz took over for Ted Williams, and he was boy, those were big shoes to fill. Nobody has filled big shoes in sports history like D.D. Gregorius of the New York Yankees. He took over for Jeter, and boy, did he get it done last night. Worldwide, this is Bloomberg.
David Gura here in New York, Tom Keene in Washington for the IMF World Bank annual meeting. He's going to reiterate what Karen just mentioned, JP Morgan reporting third quarter earnings just a few moments ago. The company down 0.25% in pre-market trading. Third quarter adjusted revenue beat the highest estimate. We saw beat when it came to investment banking as well. Came in at $1.71 billion versus the estimate of $1.65 billion. Fixed sales and trading revenue slightly lower than expected. $3.16 billion, the estimate $3.18 billion. That's down about 27%, but in line with what many analysts expected. And Ken Leon joins us now. He's a bank analyst at CFRA. He's on our phone line. I should say we expect earnings from Citi here in just about 40 minutes time as well. Ken, let's look at FIC in particular here. Is this still just a low volatility story?
You had really tough comparisons with a strong quarter last year. The third quarter also is seasonally the softest. We just didn't have enough market volatility and customer participation. So I suspect that we'll see improvement in the fourth quarter. And then, you know, what's on the on-deck circle is if you have a improving interest rate environment for banks, that's also going to help fixed income trading.
I think the last time we spoke, we were talking about how this bank was doing getting credit losses in check. Now another quarter in, how does it look? How's this bank doing?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it really ties into loan quality, making sure that there's adequate reserves, increasing the lending standards both on the commercial side but also consumer for areas like mortgage financing as well as automotive loans as well. So I think J.P. Morgan, especially more than its peers, has a real strong eye on credit quality.
A strong eye on credit quality. I know something you're looking at closely are efficiency ratios. Tell us a bit about what they tell you about the health of a bank. And now that we've got earnings from J.P. Morgan, let's focus on that bank in particular. When it comes to efficiency, when it comes to the efficiency ratio, how's J.P. Morgan doing?
Sure. And for listeners, what that means is for every dollar that you spend in the business, what you can get in return. So it's a ratio. And those the efficiency ratios are important, which is cost control, because that's needed really to meet or beat earnings, even ahead for fourth quarter or so. For J.P. Morgan, looking back over the last 2 years, it has done better than its peers. We've seen that ratio come down from the upper 50% to mid 55%. They, at a conference last month, the CFO talked about 53%. It's kind of an inverse ratio. So the more it goes down, the better it is. But they didn't give that as official guidance. So what the biggest areas for efficiency is consolidating bank branches, but it's also IT processing and other areas like that, even shifting to the cloud from computer hardware.
What do we know about the regulatory landscape at this point? This has been a big risk factor, a big point of uncertainty here as we look at these banks, as we've looked at them since the election of last year, now almost a year ago. Do we have more confidence in what the regulatory landscape is going to look like and how that's going to affect these banks?
Yes. So with a new bank supervisor at the Federal Reserve, we see more pragmatic regulation, and that may open up opportunities to refine the rules as it relates to the Volcker rule, and that could help fixed income trading. Also having better coordination among the government agencies, even using the same law, Dodd-Frank, there's different interpretations. So I think what J.P. Morgan wants is just fair play.
Ken, let me ask you lastly here. I mentioned we're going to get Citi earnings at 8 o'clock Wall Street time. What are you going to be looking for in that report from Citi?
There's really two things. One, on the growth side, is how they're doing outside the U.S., particularly in their lead franchise in Mexico and emerging markets. Second would be related to credit cards, not only the growth, but also the credit quality. That's a strong franchise for Citi is credit cards.
Ken, appreciate the time this morning. That's Ken Leon. He's a bank analyst at CFRA, giving us some commentary on J.P. Morgan, which reported earnings just a few minutes ago. As I mentioned, Citi coming out a little bit later this morning. Citi's certainly a bank with a more global flavor than J.P. Morgan. And I just want to draw your attention to some commentary from Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan. He said the global economy continues to do well, and the U.S. consumer remains healthy with solid wage growth. He's commenting in the third quarter earnings statement, as I mentioned, we just got a few moments ago. We'll have coverage of the Citi earnings here coming up on Bloomberg Surveillance. David Gura in New York, Tom Keene in Washington, D.C. today. Earnings season getting underway in earnest today. David Gura here in New York. Tom Keene, the headquarters of the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., there for the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. And Tom, I keep returning to this interview that the Financial Times did with Wolfgang Schäuble, who is the outgoing finance minister from Germany. I think he's going to be in Washington as well. But he talked about new bubbles emerging in the European economy in particular. And I know that our next guest, Klaus Regling, someone well-equipped to talk about what he's seeing when it comes to bubbles, if any, in Europe right now.
Well, absolutely, David. No question about that. And always one of our favorite moments here at the meetings of the International Monetary Fund, a conversation with Klaus Regling. Many in America don't know who he is, but you know the alphabet soup that he represents, and that would be the ESM and the EFSF. People say this at cocktail parties. They go, well, I was reading a brief from the EFSF, and they really don't even know what they're talking about. What is the European Stability Mechanism, and what is the organization, the European Financial Stability Facility? What are these two groups?
Well, these two institutions serve the same purpose. The EFSF, complicated name, was set up early in the middle of the crisis in 2010 as a temporary institution. And then 2 years later, we created the ESM, European Stability Mechanism, as a permanent international institution. So the two have the same purpose, to help countries that lose market access to get money from public funds. This is something the International Monetary Fund has been doing
around the world for more than 50 years. We now have our own institution in Europe that follows the same approach. Namely, we provide money to a government that has problems getting the money in the market, but only against conditionality. Conditionality means the country has to agree on a reform program with us, with the European Commission, the ECB, and they only get money when they really implement those reforms, and we check that on a regular basis. So that's like the IMF.
Very nicely explained. This is a distinctive year in that it seems to be all clear. We have an optimistic IMF on the global economic tone. Interview after interview tells us of a better Europe. Can you say all clear for Europe right now?
Yes, and I'm not surprised because I have been a bit more optimistic than some commentators and even the IMF for the last 2 years. And I was more optimistic because part of my job is to talk with investors around the world, because we issue bonds to finance our lending operations to countries. So I have been hearing that for some time, that Europe is now considered a safe haven, a really safe place to invest. There were concerns about a year ago about political developments, Brexit, which I think is costly for the UK, but the implications for the rest of Europe are limited. That's clearer now. There were elections where some people were worried that, that populist people might take over in France and Netherlands. It did not happen. So on the political side, it's much better, and the economic numbers look very good right now.
Is the mix between politics, corporations, and the people the same now as 2006 in Europe? Or is it, as we saw within the German election, is there a new Europe? Is there a generational shift to a different cocktail of society within Europe?
There is a shift, I think, not only in Europe. I think we see this backlash against globalization around the world, certainly in the advanced economies, in the US, UK, continental Europe, also countries outside the EU and Switzerland. We have seen big populist movements for some time. So I think this is a more global issue. It's not a European. We have to pay attention to that. I think the population today is more aware that they are losers from globalization, from cross-border cooperation. It's good for the country as a whole, but economists have known that forever. There are winners and losers. On average, there are more winners than losers, but I think we have to do maybe a bit more for those who lose or potentially lose. And here Europe has a big advantage. We have our very developed welfare and social system, which was often criticized in the past.
Right.
And we had to streamline it, make it more effective. But I think it is the right answer for these new problems that are becoming more prominent. Also, income distribution in Europe is the best in the world. Much better than US or China.
President Trump would say it's the worst in the world. He would want to see an entrepreneurial Lockean philosophy of America, every man for himself. And of course, Germany's pushed against that for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, well, if one looks at the number, whether Gini coefficient or economists have different ways to look at income distribution, It looks a lot better, according to all statistics, a lot better in Europe than in the US. And in the US, it has been deteriorating further the last 10 years. So I think this is something that I'm not in charge of. It's a difficult issue. Mm-hmm. I hope the government can see that. But in Europe, that's another strength we have at the moment.
I want to go to your economics and your esteemed career out of the University of Hamburg and all that you've done at the IMF and now for the people of Europe and of Germany. And that is the presumed glide path of quantitative tightening. At some point, the U.S., at some point, Europe, with Mr. Draghi and other societies, have to turn the punch bowl off, the interest rate punch bowl and the balance sheet punch bowl. Do you have a confidence that institutions can do this smoothly?
Yes, of course. We all know that monetary policy is implementing non-conventional policies in response to the crisis, which was absolutely necessary in response to the crisis. Because it's unconventional, it has to be reversed at one point. Europe, in its cyclical developments, is a bit behind the US, so I think we learn how the Federal Reserve is doing it very cautiously. Communication is important, and I think the ECB will look at that very carefully.
This is the first time I've ever asked this question. Klaus Regling with us, folks. Wonderful to have him begin our coverage here in the offices of the International Monetary Fund in their atrium. It's about an 8-story atrium. It sort of looks like an outtake from Star Wars. I don't know, remember which movie, but there it is. Klaus, I've never asked this question. Can there be such an optimism that the European unemployment rate, maybe it doesn't get to the American rate because there's different ways to calculate, but can it come down under double digit and really get down towards what we see in the United Kingdom and in the United States?
Well, it is already today below double digit. It's around 9.1%, okay. So it has been falling now already for 3 years. It's still then a lot higher than the U.S. I don't think it will come down to the U.S. level. You're right, there are some methodological issues here. But when we talk about the labor market in a broader sense, there's one interesting observation that speaks in favor of Europe, despite the fact that the unemployment is significantly higher. The employment rate, which means the number of people of working age who have a job, has increased steadily in Europe the last 20 years. It's higher now than the year 2000, which means a higher percentage of the people have a job than in the year 2000. While in the U.S., despite the low unemployment rate, that employment rate is lower today than 20 years ago.
I've got to finish off, and you're going to go, I really don't want to comment on the Trump administration, and I certainly don't want to comment on the uproar in the last 12 hours of the IMF and tax reform, what they've said about a responsible policy of tax reform and growing deficits. But I must ask you that within your studies, have you ever seen a certitude that lower taxes ultimately lead to higher economic growth? We asked Olivier Blanchard this a few days ago. He was heated that it's not within the literature. Do you see within the Germanic literature you studied that you could spur growth through abrupt tax reform and lower taxes?
I think that's a difficult question because it's not only the level of individual taxes, but it's also the composition of the entire tax structure. And economists know that a certain revenue structure can be more growth-friendly or less growth-friendly, and therefore also lower taxes can be more growth-friendly than higher taxes. But I think it very much depends on the composition, which tax you look at.
Well, the ambiguity of the economics that we see here. Klaus Regling, thank you so much with the ESM. Today at the International Monetary Fund meetings. David, it'll be really interesting to speak to Madame Lagarde over this uproar on tax reform and lecturing the Trump administration.
Weeks back, I had the great fortune, great opportunity to sit down with the president of the country of Colombia. Juan Manuel Santos was here in New York for the UN General Assembly meetings, and front and center for that country then still is the situation in Venezuela. And something that the president pointed out to me, Tom, is it's a country, Venezuela is, that has the largest reserves of oil in the whole world. He said, quote, "The Venezuelan situation could very easily be improved if they have a good government." Venezuela having an abundance of oil, Colombia reckoning with the fact that it does not have as much as its neighbor. And I know that's something we're going to discuss here with our next guest who joins you in the atrium at the IMF.
Well, that would be the mother of all adjacencies, certainly within the Western Hemisphere. That's something that the minister studied at the University of California at Berkeley a few years ago. And, of course, it's wonderful to have a semi-annual and annual visit with the minister, Mr. Cardenas of Colombia. The adjacencies here are so important. Most Americans don't understand that Venezuela could be the Saudi Arabia of the oil business. What is the knock-on effect of the turmoil in Caracas to your nation?
Well, we have 300,000 Venezuelans now living in Colombia. People that have crossed the border looking for food, for health. Colombia has welcomed them. We're providing free education, access to emergency care in our health facilities, and obviously food, which is the most scarce product today.
Day to day, the food, getting the food.
Day to day.
The Turks say the same
Many
thing.
People living in our border city, Cúcuta, is a city of more than 1 million inhabitants, and there are many Venezuelans now camping in the streets of Cúcuta. So Colombia is really a country that is very interested in finding a solution to Venezuela,
Colombia,
a political solution.
The Colombia success, I think all of our listeners and our viewers know, has been extraordinary in that you've had to pull back your GDP estimates a little bit. Is that just because of the drop in oil prices, or is it a more complex?
No, it's mostly that. The Venezuelan factor has played a role. Mm-hmm. I mean, at one point, we had $6 billion in trade with Venezuela. Now that's practically zero. That means that we lost our exports to Venezuela. Venezuela was a very good market for Colombian goods, food, manufactured products. So we lost that. But mostly the lower growth numbers mm-hmm. in Colombia, which will be close to 2% this year, right. 3% next year, is the result of lower revenues from oil.
There is an uproar this morning about tax reform in the United States of America and the thoughts of the IMF. What they didn't notice at the White House is Colombia has lived tax reform.
Yeah.
You're the experiment for what we're arguing about here. Now, to be clear here, you raise taxes to bring the deficit in, right?
Right. Well, we have experience with that. And by the way, we talk a lot with the American officials. I had a meeting yesterday with Secretary Mnuchin. We talked frequently with Gary Kahn because the dynamics and the politics of tax reform is similar in all democracies. So what Colombia did was to cut corporate taxes, not to 20% as it is the plan here in the U.S., but we did that without increasing the fiscal deficit, which is a very important element. We have the rating agencies, of course, looking at our numbers. So we couldn't afford a reduction in revenues. We had to offset that with an increase in the VAT. Yeah. That was the difficult part, raising the VAT rate from 16 to 19%.
Yeah. I think I'm going to do this. Let me bring in my colleague in New York, David Gura. David?
Yeah. Mr. Cardenas, let me ask you about the prospects for a peace dividend. We saw the formal politicization of the FARC now, that they've become a political party within the government. There are people here who are counting on things changing, their quality of life changing. Are we beginning to see the contours of a peace dividend in Colombia today?
Well, tourism is kind of like the sector, the low-hanging fruit, because Colombia was certainly affected by the conflict in the sense that many tourists were warned against visiting Colombia. Now people are interested in coming to Colombia, a country that has the Andean Mountains, the Amazon Basin, the Caribbean coast. I mean, a number of attractions. So this is the sector that is picking up the most as a first response to peace. But others will come, like agriculture, for example. So the peace dividend is already evident, but it's just at the beginning stage.
I'll editorialize and say it's a surveillance dividend, and some of team surveillance has just enjoyed the wonderful tourism of Colombia. Minister, it wasn't David or myself, I should say.
No, I will add that. I would love
to
go.
Thank you so much for visiting with us. Mauricio Cardenas is a Minister of Finance for Colombia. Wonderful guest, and this is not the norm, folks, within the Fed Derby in Washington, not too far from this IMF headquarters or what we see at the Bank of England or at other major central banks. If you think of Richard Thaler, who just won the Nobel Prize in Economics and the Heritage of Chicago, You go back to Frank Knight of 1921 and the idea of uncertainty. In our developed economies, there's no greater uncertainty than the political mess in South Africa. Joining us now is a gentleman who has to courageously deal with this each and every day. He is a central bank governor for South Africa, Lesetse Kanyano. Wonderful to have you with us, sir, within the uncertainties of South Africa and really the crucible of going day to day. How stable is the government right now, and how can you help the people of South Africa get to a better place?
Well, government is stable. There is political contestation in South Africa. Political contestation takes place in all of the democracies. What is important for South Africa is that institutions of our democracy are working, and it is those institutions which are the protectors of our democracy. And South Africans had figured out how to utilize these institutions to defend their democracy.
If the South African rand is a litmus paper of any given nation and the currency movement and such, what does the rand tell you now about the choices that you have, the options, the degrees of freedom that you have as a central banker?
Well, what the currency tells us is that, firstly, there is global realignment of exchange rates, and that is expected, that should take place. But there are South African idiosyncrasies that have to do with the political uncertainty that that we have. And with the political uncertainty comes policy uncertainty. And the exchange rates would tend to react to those developments. What does it mean for monetary policy? To the extent that you have an exchange rate that moves, whether it has depreciated or has appreciated, as a central bank, we have got to ask ourselves the question, is this a once-off shock, or is this something that could lead to a second-round effect?
Let me bring in my colleague in New York, David Gura, with the head of the Central Bank of South Africa. David?
Governor, great to speak with you. Let me just ask you what you intend to talk to IMF officials about this week. You're there in Washington for these meetings. What's on the agenda for you?
Well, the most important thing was coming to grips with the what is happening with the global economy, and speaking to colleagues from various regions and establish what the prospects are for the global economy. And the take at the moment is that the global economy is in a recovery phase, that this recovery is much more broad-based. It goes across regions, and that it gives an opportunity for countries to take advantage of this resurgence in growth. But secondly is that people are starting to ask important questions, and it comes across very strongly that we actually need to be having growth being inclusive, that we should not be leaving vast sections of our populations behind. The third area has to do with globalization, that there is no doubt that globalization has taken millions of people out of poverty. But questions are starting to be asked. Could we have more equitable globalization? Could we be having more equitable trade? And some of the discussions that are coming is concerns that are starting to emerge that there are aspects of trade protectionism that seem to be emerging, and that could actually threaten the global economic recovery.
Do you expect to utter the two words debt relief over the course of these meetings? Are you at that point yet where you need to go to the IMF?
Our fundamentals are still solid, even if we are expecting that there will be some revenue shortfall, and the Minister of Finance will be tabling the budget policy statement in 13 days' time, our fundamentals are solid. But more importantly is that South Africa has access to a very deep domestic capital market, but also has demonstrated our ability to be able to access international capital markets. So there isn't any indication at the moment that you suggest that South Africa might have to run to the IMF.
Within the research capabilities, we've been asking this question of all sorts of people within the commodity space. Within the research capabilities of your central bank in South Africa, is there any whisper that the commodity bear market is over on a nominal or real basis? Forget about one mineral or one metal, just the idea of a lift to commodities. Is it tangible?
Well, the lift is tangible, but we must not kid ourselves. I don't think that we will get back to the commodity cycle that we even characterized as a super cycle. And part of it has to do with the fact that China, which was a key a consumer of these commodities, is actually rebalancing its growth and is starting to focus more on consumption than it has on investment. So it has got implications for the industrial for the industrial commodities in particular.
I have to ask you a more narrow question about South Africa, and it has to do with the American and the European focus on Cape Town, on Johannesburg. How is Durban doing? Is Durban looking more eastward and more across the Indian Ocean? Does Durban have a unique place within South Africa in terms of spurring future global trade?
Well, it is our most important port. Most of our exports and imports come through the port of Durban, and it doesn't matter whether the exports or imports are going east or are going west. It is our major trade port. It is a major city, and it has got a fantastic climate. You must visit it.
Well, I know we must visit it. David and I want to do that in the summer of Durban, which would be, I think, February of this year. But within this, Governor, is the idea of what you need in a time where multilateral trade discussions have disappeared. What is the bilateral discussion with the United States, as an example, that will spur development in Durban?
Well, there had been bilateral discussions with the United States, and at the time it had to do with the extension of the Africa Growth Opportunity Act. It is a major policy framework in as far as the U.S. and Africa are concerned with respect to trade. And South Africa is a very important trading partner for the U.S. So our engagement platform with the U.S. Tended to be through the AGOA.
Last question here, just about inflation targeting. This is something that we talk about here in the States a lot, if that if the target that we have in place should be adjusted some. Are you weighing that as well? You're looking at 3 to 6% inflation. Should that be lowered, do you think?
Well, unless South Africa achieves lower inflation, we would lose competitiveness. So what we had seen is that we had had this inflation rate target band of 3 to 6 since the inception of inflation targeting in South Africa. We did revise it once and adjusted the band to 3 to 5, but we were hit by a shock and we reinstated it back to 3 to 6. After the previous monetary policy meeting, we actually did indicate that we are starting to focus more on a quarterly projection model, and that quarterly projection model doesn't work with the inflation target bands, but it works with a point. And we are using the midpoint of the target range at 4.5, and that is what we watch. And we actually made it clear that we would prefer to see inflation expectations gravitating towards the midpoint of that inflation target range.
We'll leave it there, Governor. Thank you very much for the time. That's Lesetke Kyango. He's the Governor of the South African Reserve Bank, joining Tom and me from the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank in Washington, D.C. More coverage of that event throughout the morning here on Bloomberg Surveillance and Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.